I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 18th of July. This hour, an article in the Columbia Journalism Review for July-August caught our attention. It is titled, Lighten Up, How Satire Will Make American Politics Relevant Again, and the author of the piece is with us this hour, Danigal Young, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Delaware and a Research Fellow at the University Center for Political Communication. She also, doesn't this sound like fun, been a professional improvisational comedian with Comedy Sports in Philadelphia for some 14 years. She has looked at what's happened to news over the course of the past 20 years or so, and media deregulation of the 80s and 90s, increasing pressure on the news industry to cut costs and maximize profits. So out the window went a lot of investigative reporting and foreign coverage and an emphasis on news that was hyper-personalized, fragmented, overly dramatic. She became outraged and started looking for solutions, as did a lot of people. How to think harder, look more carefully, read more. And thought, although there has been some controversy about this, started looking at satire, particularly shows like The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert's Rapport, how they have the potential for significant reach and also significant influence. What kind of influence? We're going to be talking about that. It also gives us a chance to play a few clips from The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, and to examine the audience and to look at other possibilities for us to get what we perhaps used to get, or maybe this is something entirely new. We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You may know a great deal about political satire through history and can point to times in history when we've looked at that. You may be big fans of both The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, and maybe other shows, maybe Bill Maher's show, other shows that treat the news in different kind of fashions. So we'd love to hear from you. The email is talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dana Young, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Kathleen.
Our pleasure. Let's talk about what happened to news back in the 80s and the 90s, because something significant happened.
Right. You know, a lot of the work that's been done on this and the looking back at sort of changes in the news industry in the context of examining the rise of satire was done by a friend and colleague, Jeff Boehm, who's at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And he actually has this book called From Cronkite to Colbert, where he looks at these transformations not only in media economics, but also in media technologies. And what he argues happened is that during the 1980s, under the Reagan administration, mass media industries were largely deregulated. Okay, so that means that you have the rise of what are now these sort of giant corporate entities and these megalopolies that own across the media landscape, right? Your Disney's, your Viacom's, your Comcast. And part of what's unique about their structure is that they are very focused on the bottom line, right? Maximizing profits, pleasing shareholders. And how do you do that when your product is news? Well, you do that by minimizing production costs, right? Which, as you were indicating in the intro, is about cutting foreign bureaus and cutting stuff that takes a lot of time but doesn't have a whole lot of product,
right?
Which is investigative reporting.
Right.
You know, when you look at the kind of work that is required for an expose like you know, your Watergate scandal, that's a whole lot of time, a whole lot of effort, without a whole lot of reward in terms of the writing product that comes out of that. Now a lot of our news organizations don't allow the room to breathe for that kind of long-term investigative reporting to happen. They also have a tendency to skew the news towards what is designed to bring in the highest ratings. Of course, we know this, right? Sensationalism, drama, high crimes that may not be representative of larger systemic epidemics, but that are unique and maybe horrifying, to draw our attention. And those do tend to get eyeballs. The problem, as I see it, and I talk to students about this a lot, is we operate in a free market system, and we tend to think that capitalism breeds quality, right? You know, if you have competition in the marketplace, you have different kinds of green beans, you're going to end up with better quality green beans, and the ones that aren't as high quality are going to end up having to be cheaper, or they're just not going to sell. That works when we are motivated to get the highest quality. Unfortunately, when it comes to public journalism, what we want isn't always what we need, which is shocking, right? So we tend to really want chocolate cake, and we don't want the green beans at all. So that ends up sort of doing a disservice to the public. And there's a lot of hesitation on the part of media executives to say, we know what the public needs. You know, that has this sort of elitist feel to it, and it feels patriarchal, like, oh, we know what the public needs, so we're going to give them what they need. But at some level, somebody's going to interject and say, for people to be able to vote on public policy issues, to be able to make good decisions and sound decisions, maybe they don't need 24-hour coverage of the George Zimmerman trial. Maybe we do need more attention paid to foreign affairs and what's going on in Egypt right now, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, you end up with this sort of hole in the news where there are people who are looking for substantive, investigative, nuanced approaches to really complex issues, and those aren't being delivered, especially on, like, your CNN. So we find that there was this untapped niche, right? And who best to serve those interests other than comedians, artists, people who aren't so wedded to that existing journalistic system?
Mm-hmm.
And so what John Stewart did was he experimented and gave us a flavor that is entirely new.
And what's interesting in watching those shows, and I watch them as often as I can, is that it requires, I think, a kind of political sophistication. So people will lament the fact, oh, you're watching a comedy show to get your news. This is terrible. But you have to understand quite a bit about politics in order to get in the spirit of that show and enjoy that show.
Absolutely. A lot of the early research that was coming out when I started looking at this in the early 2000s, what we found was that there was a Pew report by the Pew Center for the People and the Press. And it found that over time, young people were less likely to be consuming nightly news and newspapers and were more likely to report consuming comedy shows like Stewart and Colbert wasn't on the air yet, but like those kinds of things. So many people made the claim that young people were not consuming traditional news at all and were consuming comedy shows instead. And some subsequent research that I did with my colleague Russ Peisinger found that that's actually not true. The people who are watching Colbert, Stewart, and even Leno and Letterman, right, these are people who actually are more likely, not less likely, to be consuming news of some kind. They're not really, the Stewart and Colbert viewers aren't watching your traditional nightly network news broadcast. They're also not really watching local news, nor are they reading hard copy newspapers. But they do tend to consume news online a lot. They do tend to watch cable news, and they tend to be avid public radio audiences.
Mm-hmm. Good for them. We like that.
Yes.
That's great. There have been charges, and you cite these in your article among some scholars, that Mr. Stewart has engaged in unbridled political cynicism, so that the young people or the older people, everybody watching that show, is just going to be terribly cynical about American democracy and politics beyond our shores. We're just going to be a nation of cynics.
Well, Rod Hart, who's the dean of the Communications School at the University of Texas at Austin, he and I loved debating this because he is a really colorful rhetorician, and he explores the language of Stuart and has made some really broad claims about how harmful these kinds of shows are to our sense of sort of public participation, political engagement, how we think about the system in general. And when we talk, I really, it's a compelling argument that he makes that, yes, Stuart, because Stuart is criticizing the individuals in the system, in the system itself, the viewers, he argues, are going to say, well, it's, the whole game is rigged. No one is in it for the to serve the public interest. So therefore, you know, forget it. I'm going to take my ball and go home. Except, well, first of all, the data don't bear that out. The data actually show a very opposite narrative, and that is that the people who watch these shows continue to be engaged. They continue to pay attention. They continue to participate. They talk about politics. One of the things that we find, though, that people have said is a negative, Stewart and Colbert viewers do have lower trust in government than non-viewers of those shows across the board. Mm-hmm. And this is controlling for all kinds of socio-demographics. It's controlling for political ideology and party and all and age and all that. But I would argue that that's not necessarily a bad thing either. If you find that people don't trust the government or they think that politicians are self-interested, is that necessarily dysfunctional? It's dysfunctional if those people then decide to tune out because the system is so far gone.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what we're finding with these viewers. They don't trust the government, but they continue to be engaged. So that, for me, is a positive.
Yeah. Let's listen to, for people who have never heard Stephen Colbert, we want to listen to a little bit of Stephen Colbert. And this points to how they can be learning opportunities as well. This is a clip of Stephen Colbert interviewing Nancy Pelosi about the influence of super PACs on elections and the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. And I know that our guest also writes about how Colbert was able to, you know, form this super PAC and really get people involved in the whole problematic part of Super PACs and Citizen United as a result of what he did on the television. So listen to some of this, and then we'll have our guest analyze it. And we'll be welcoming phone. Oh, we got so much going on. We'll be welcoming phone calls to Dana Young, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Delaware, is our guest. She also, and I wonder if she does political improvisation, is a comedian with Comedy Sports in Philadelphia. The piece that we're talking about this hour, Lighten Up, How Satire Will Make American Politics Relevant Again. And we'll take phone calls. So here is Stephen Colbert and Nancy Pelosi.
Please welcome Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi. Madam, you know, I'm grateful that you came on, but you have attacked me.
Yes.
You have attacked me in the person of my super PAC by saying that super PACs and I specifically am hurting democracy. What do you mean?
Well, I think that if we want to cancel elections and just have the wealthiest people in America, and you know what their names are, give millions of tens of millions of dollars, we can just ask them, who do they want to be president? Who do they want to run Congress? Who do they want to be governor?
That would be polite.
No, that would be...
it's an option.
That would be a plutocracy, and we are a democracy, and our founders intended that the people would decide.
All right. Now you've hit on something. In the Citizens United decision the Supreme Court made 2 years ago, they said because corporations are legally people, and because people have the right to free speech, and because money is speech, therefore corporations have the right, and individuals and unions, to spend unlimited amounts of money in political speech.
Nancy Pelosi and the Colbert Report, and you write about this, actually, that he used all of this as a way to actually, and you can hear the enthusiasm from the audience on that audio clip, and people really learned the process by learning about his super PAC, right?
Yeah, this went on for months, I think over a year, that Stephen and his writers and producers explored the Citizens United decision, and what super PACs were going to do to the election, and what super PACs were legally able to facilitate on behalf of really wealthy donors. And you can hear that he gets really excited about it as well.
Right.
There are several studies that are out there right now that are showing that viewers of Colbert did learn a substantial amount regarding super PACs, Citizens United decision, campaign finance reform, what is legal and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, let's be honest, these are tedious and downright boring, dirty details of campaign finance. So to make this interesting, I think it really did take playing this part and having this ironic persona and exploring it in this ironic way for people to really get a sense, oh my gosh, this entire system is geared to serve people unlike anyone that I will ever know in my life.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you said, though, to make this interesting, do we run the risk of having to do a show like that? It's just like being an entertaining teacher. You've got to be a performer. You got to make people laugh in order to be fully engaged with the serious nature. Isn't it incumbent on us as members of a democracy to be serious at times, to read through Citizens United and do the hard work as citizens to understand it?
Yeah, great point. And it is fair to say that if you are not consuming any traditional sort of investigative or substantive journalism, first of all, these shows are not going to be appealing to you because you're not going to understand them, and you're not going to see yourself as the kind of person that could understand mm-hmm. these shows. So there is certainly baseline knowledge that's necessary to understand them. But even so, there's something kind of reciprocal then that happens when you have someone who's kind of a clown like Colbert, and I don't mean clown in a sort of condescending way. I mean that he's bringing levity to this and really engaging the audience. We have found that in addition to sort of needing that background knowledge to understand it, then something like a Colbert where he takes on the super PACs can really motivate people to learn more. And one of the things we found most recently is it increases citizens' own sense of confidence in their ability to navigate these complex issues. So I watch Colbert, I laugh about super PACs, I start becoming more familiar with what they are. I become a little dismayed that all these things Colbert is doing are legal, which is shocking. But I start to get it. And then when I hear out in the world through traditional media info about Citizens United and super PACs, I think, I'm the kind of person who knows what that is.
Right.
I get it.
Right. Yeah,
this
exactly.
This is not a conversation for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
It's for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that has all kinds of beneficial effects for citizens.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Dana Young is our guest. She has a piece in the Columbia Journalism Review for July-August. Lighten Up, How Satire Will Make American Politics Relevant Again. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You're a pretty sophisticated audience when it comes to politics and all kinds of issues, actually. I'm sure that many of you listening watch these satire shows, The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and perhaps can point to others. What do they give you? And what other sources do you go to supplement your need for news, your need to know what's going on? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we do want to correct something, or actually add something, to yesterday's conversation on our show on the 12 best companies for working families, the piece in Working Mother magazine. We overlooked, alas, alas, the Mercy Health System, which is headquartered in Janesville. Our mistake. It was on the list, Mercy Health System. Congratulations. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
Hello, Danny. I put in mind here of the famous Lily Tomlin quote, no matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up. But what I wanted to ask about is, since you'd brought up public radio, Are you familiar with the public radio program, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? And
yes,
if so,
yes.
How would you classify that in terms of the type of material you're discussing?
Interesting. Oh, good question. You know, I've been asked that before. I've been asked if I sort of looked into that program and looked into the effects of it. I think that as opposed to doing sort of pointed, sort of in-depth satire, that show does a wonderful job with their sort of humorous guests, really quickly pointing fun or poking fun at various current event stories. So I don't know if that's always consistently satirical, but it's certainly political humor. And I would say that that's another mechanism to bring humor and levity to what we generally think of as serious politics.
Scott, do you watch Colbert in The Daily Show?
I do sometimes, and I am always intrigued by, the same really is true of Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm intrigued by who wants to be on there.
Really?
That I find interesting, yeah.
Huh.
You know, it seems to me that it's become all of those types of programs have become such smash hits, and I'm assuming Wait, Don't Tell Me is doing pretty well on public radio.
I believe it
radio.
Is, yes.
And, I mean, just the people who would come on there, you know, because you're taking a risk. And, you know, and you, I think you, you know, you put yourself in a position where I guess maybe, well, I've been real interested all over time to watch the migration of leaving the late night talk shows. You know, there was I'm old enough to remember when you would never see anybody who was like a serious politician or certainly running for president show up on one of these shows, and then all of a sudden there they are.
Mm-hmm.
These have become the venues where, you know, it's like remember Bill Clinton playing the sax on what was it, Arsenio Hall show?
Right.
Arsenio Hall.
You
know,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm one of you. You know, and I can take a joke, and I think it's a real interesting phenomenon.
I do too.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
I was just thinking about the when your guest Scott says that he remembers a time when, you know, candidates did not do that. Even now when they do it, there's still a lot of backlash. I mean, when Barack Obama went on The View, I believe it was the 2012 election, there was a lot of criticism that it's just not presidential for him to be sort of sitting on a couch chit-chatting about family issues and joking about things that are not necessarily strictly political. But I think that the campaigns themselves understand that voters are really looking for a sense of who these individuals are as people. We can debate whether or not that is normatively a positive or a negative thing. But the campaigns understand that that is how people approach campaigns, is how the citizens do, is looking at these people as people, and a willingness to play and poke fun at oneself and be comfortable and to be in an environment that is not as controlled, like on the couch of Stewart or Colbert, that it's high risk.
Right.
And, you know, how authentic do they seem in that environment? Some of them don't do well, actually.
If you don't have a sense of humor, stay off that show.
Yes.
Any of them, right? What do you think of Bill Maher?
Oh, well, what do you mean exactly?
Do you like, you know, I think that we've had a similar reaction. I have watched him, my family watches him, and I find him, maybe this is, you know, I have sensitive taste at times, and it gets a little bit crude for me. Although I like the panel and I like the idea of people from very different political persuasions, but I know that you were upset by it and you probably, like me, have, I don't know if I love it, but I watch it occasionally.
Yeah, I feel like I sort of have a duty to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on over there.
Right.
I did, as I say in the article, you know, I was trained as a political scientist and as a political philosophy concentration, actually. So early on, before I started looking at satire, I was a viewer like everyone else, and I remember watching Bill Maher and these random comedians and musicians who were on his show back when he was on ABC, prior to 9/11. And really just feeling like, who are these people and what gives them the right to talk about politics?
Right.
They're just, you know, and you still hear that claim now. What I learned through starting to research this stuff is that, guess what? In a true democracy, everyone has a right to talk about whatever they want publicly. And those points of view that are offered by those C and D-list comedians really might resonate with the way that real people talk about politics. So I had to do some soul-searching and realize that I was being kind of elitist in my own way. That being said, over the past, I'd say, 5 years, Bill Maher has moved in a direction where sometimes he is so strident in his political beliefs that he can almost move away from satire. He's not being ironic. He's saying exactly what he thinks, and he's saying it in a way that is very pointed.
Yes.
And he might use humor to create an analogy between some political situation and some outrageous situation. But for some people, that's a little hard to swallow.
Right, yeah. Let's go to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I've just a couple comments. Number one, I'm a little bit upset with what I'm hearing. I think there's a clear differentiation in that Bill Maher, Jon Stewart, and Stephen Colbert, I think, need to be kept in mind are entertainers and not political, what do you call them, commenters, you know, not political analysts. And by the satirical view that they take, they kind of put themselves above everyone else and say, well, we have the answer. We can poke fun at this. Now, while I believe you need a sense of humor to be in politics and be poked fun at once in a while, I believe there's a grave difference between being poked fun at and being made fun of.
Mm.
And I think that does a serious damage to, we may be a little more aware, but aware of what? I mean, if you look at when I open the paper and I see a political satire cartoon, you can't help but see that the cartoonist has an axe to grind one way or the other, and I see these guys as the same way. I would rather get my facts, as the guest says, or be made aware of facts, by the professionals in politics. After all, that is their job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've kind of blurred a line between entertainment and politics, and I don't think those two should mix.
Let me ask you, Mike, where do you go to do the hard work? What kind of hard work do you do in order to become informed?
When somebody tells me the Obamacare thing, I go look it up. I dig it up online.
Okay.
Until I find usgov.
Okay.
I find my I didn't know what a super PAC was either. I don't watch much TV, probably an hour a week.
Mm-hmm.
But I go online and I dig. Until I find the answer, because I think that the country needs to be a country of strong individuals, not individuals led by Colbert or Stewart or
anybody.
Need to be led
right.
by themselves, and that there's their power to vote.
Yeah. Hey, here's to you. You're doing the hard work. What do you say?
Yeah. I would just say that Mike is in the minority here in terms of the hard work that he's doing, where he's going to original sources and trying to understand things for himself. That takes a lot of time and a lot of commitment. And he is not alone in his belief that entertainment and politics shouldn't mix. I happen to just be on the other side of the debate from that because I see how it can engage and mobilize people who otherwise might drop out of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly do not believe that entertainment and political entertainment is somehow a replacement for what we get through true substantive public affairs content. We cannot function as citizens without someone who is empowered through time and resources to do the hard work and get to the bottom of the story. The problem is a lot of what is out there is not that. So part of what I see Stewart and Colbert doing is exposing that very problem. Because remember, they're not just political satirists. They're largely media satirists, and they're largely criticizing the lack of journalism of the kind that I think your guest Mike would prefer to have and to see. So they I don't think that they want to be a replacement. Stewart one time said, you know, the popularity of our show and the fact that we get awards and critical acclaim for, like, journalism says far more about the, I think he used an expletive, but I'll just say, the
right.
poor state of journalism than it does about the importance of our show.
Let's welcome more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Here's a Facebook comment from Marilyn. Saturday Night Live seems a safer place for Republicans than some of the other shows. Chris Christie is on this weekend, but watch out, Sarah Palin. I love Jon Stewart, John Oliver, and Stephen Colbert. We haven't talked very much about Saturday Night Live.
No, that's interesting. And I think that that's a really astute comment because, you know, as much as Saturday Night Live has historically leaned, you know, slightly left, it's still a network program that needs to appeal to as largely as possible to a mass audience. So it does make sense that they are more mainstream in that regard, and they are equal opportunity offenders. Stewart and Colbert do not really make any bones about what it is that they're doing, and I think that they are very clear with the fact that they do lean to the left. SNL does seem to be a more, perhaps a friendlier venue
right.
for those right-wing guests.
I'm interested that you've done comedy sports for a long time, Dana, 14 years. Do you do...
It makes me sound very old.
Oh, you sound very young.
Goodness.
No, compared to me, you're very, very young. But do you do political satire? Is that a part of what you do in comedy sports?
No, I don't. And that's why it's funny, because I usually keep those two things quite separate. I am too far down the rabbit hole in my study of political satire to ever do it.
Oh.
What I do is straight improv. So comedy sports is... For anyone who hasn't seen it, you know, there are some wonderful comedy sports teams in Wisconsin. It's like that old show, Whose Line Is It Anyway, where you get a suggestion and you play games and make things up.
Yes.
It's all just experimental. It's all just building something from nothing. And, every once in a while I introduce political themes into a game, but it does tend to get me more in my head because I feel like I know too much. And what's interesting is actually... I find, and other people who I know who study this, find that the writers and producers of these shows, like Stewart and Colbert, really aren't that interested in talking with scholars about it. And I think it's the same idea. They, in order to do what they do, they need to move forward with abandon in pursuit of what's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start thinking about how important we are to an election or... Are we truly educating citizens? Are we empowering them? Everything gets a little cloudy.
Right.
In terms of what their mission is. So they don't really like talking to us.
More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. Dana Young, author of the piece in the Columbia Journalism Review this month, Lighten Up, How Satire Will Make American Politics Relevant Again. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Jason in Greendale next. Hi, Jason.
Hi, thank you. Listen, a couple of calls ago, you had the guy who called in. He seemed upset that people were getting their news from Colbert and Jon Stewart, but I think he's got it quite wrong. You have to already be well-informed politically and current events to even understand the jokes and get the satire that they have, you know, with the Colbert Report and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And that's what makes it funny, is that everyone who watches that show, to really get the humor, you have to already be well-rounded and well-informed. And that's why I love those shows.
Yeah, I think you're right. You do have to know what's going on, don't you, Dana?
Yes, absolutely. And what we find is that when we ask people what is it about these shows that draws you to them, for people who consider themselves fans of these shows, and I've done a bit of research on that, what motivates you or what draws you to the show? There are people who say the humor, you know, I like laughing, they're funny. There are people who say I like getting information in a funny way. But those people aren't very numerous. There are a lot of people who say I like both. I like getting I like laughing, and I like getting information at the same time. And then, most interesting to me is that there are people who say, I like watching these shows because they bring humor, and sometimes they help me get put a new sort of context around information that I already have that I've obtained somewhere else. And when you look at those people, that's like a specific subset of these viewers. What's interesting is they have a particular psychological profile. They are what's called high in need for cognition. Those are people who, if you ask them a series of questions, they enjoy thinking, they enjoy problem solving, they really enjoy sort of solving puzzles. Mm-hmm. So people who really enjoy thinking, they're going to Stewart and Colbert for a particular set of motivations having to do with context, meaning, connection, thinking more broadly, situating issues in a larger framework. And so your caller is absolutely right. In order to do that, you have to already have the information coming in.
Yeah. Let's go next. Thank you very much, Jason Curtis in Juneau. Hi.
Hi, hi, Kathleen. I really appreciate the program, and I think that the reason that people enjoy the comedians as far as getting their politics and information is because the intellectual level of the general man on the street has plummeted so much in the last 30 or 40 years that those people that watch those programs are on the fringe and they're grasping. They need something because we don't have that on national news. Walter Cronkite is gone. Walter Winchell is gone. Now, I'm not dating myself, but Cronkite I am. But those individuals are gone. And people are in such need of something that's substantial mm-hmm. that they comedy. And believe me, we're in a heap of trouble.
Dana.
Well, I would say, I would think that we were in a heap of trouble if people like you weren't aware of the fact that we were in a heap of trouble, A. And B, if there weren't some of these experimental alternatives that were highlighting this need. You're exactly right. And scholars have argued repeatedly that the popularity of these shows and the critical acclaim and the fact that they are drawing a very interesting politically elite crowd, people who are young, you know, we usually think young people are tuned out. The viewers of Colbert and Stewart are very young. They're very engaged. They're leaders. They're, you know, the people who are sort of either culture producers or opinion leaders. And the popularity of these shows speaks to the fact that these people are not getting what they feel that they need or want through traditional outlets.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than looking with despair at the landscape, which I have often done, I'll admit, I try to look with optimism and say, but at least we have these sort of experimental formats that can serve these purposes for us.
Mm-hmm.
They might not look like Cronkite, but maybe in some ways they're serving the same kind of public normative goals.
I'm with you, Curtis. I miss Walter Cronkite, too. I really liked him. Let's listen a little more. And this, I believe, is a pretty serious because it's hard not to be serious. There are occasions when on these shows it's a decided point of view and it is very serious. And I'm interested in your response and your analysis of this, Dana. This was talked about. We have young adults in our household, and this certainly was something that was all over however people send messages, YouTube or whatever they use with each other. But this is John Oliver, who's been sitting in for John Stewart while he's gone this summer, and his response, just part of it, it was a long piece to the George Zimmerman trial, fairly serious, and I'm wondering if this is unusual for these shows to take on an issue like this in this way. So, Dana, listen, and let's hear what you say. John Oliver.
The many truly depressing things about this case, where a man was found not guilty after admitting pursuing and shooting an unarmed teenager, one is just how unsurprised people seem to be about the verdict.
They had no other option given the strictures of the law in Florida.
If at any point in that altercation that Zimmerman felt that his life was in grave bodily harm or imminent danger, he had the right under Florida's law to pull that trigger.
Right. And that is what makes this so much worse. That we can get a verdict like this, not because the system has broken down, but because the system worked exactly as it's designed. How does 2013 Florida have a law that seems cut and pasted from 1881 Tombstone? Because...
What do you think of that piece? It was pretty serious, Dana.
Yeah, there are... I was fascinated by the fact that they had John Oliver do that. I think it worked well for him. I think that he is able to deliver what he does, and it's effective, in part because he's seen as a bit of a cultural outsider because he's British. So that kind of, that gives him permission to speak kind of critically, especially when dealing with issues like gun laws, which, as we know, are unique to the United States. I found it an interesting choice in a way because I wasn't sure if Oliver has the same kind of social capital with his audience at this point. I think people like him and they're like impressed and they feel like he's doing a good job. But when Stewart does that, when Stewart gets very serious and speaks to the camera in a pleading way about the insanity of a given situation, and he has done it about 9/11, he has done it about the legislation regarding some of those rescue workers from 9/11 and whether or not they were getting the hospital care that they deserved, or I forget what that bill was called. But he has looked into the camera and taken on these issues. In a way, I think it works for him because he has audience members who have been with him for years on this ride,
right,
and they get it.
Right.
I thought it was an interesting choice for Oliver, but I think, again, because of his status as a cultural outsider, I think that people were able to give him a pass and hear that. What do you think?
I think he pulled it off somehow. I thought that it was because they didn't use a whole lot of clips, which they tend to do, which is good because they hold the powerful accountable in this. I thought it was pretty dramatic because he's a really funny guy and he's usually just sort of over the top with his comedy that it came off. And I think we're used to him enough that it was a fairly powerful segment. I would love to have seen Stewart's response to it, too. I think it would have been quite strong as well. And getting back, you know, to what you were saying earlier, the other thing that's remarkable about these shows is that they use what political people and others have said. So they play their words, and then you have to think about what the words are. And it goes back to something you were talking about in the piece, that because of what's happened to the mainstream media, political professionals have learned, you write, how to use these constraints to their advantage. So they use handlers and spin machines, and it's up to shows like this to analyze their words, to hold the powerful accountable, which is unusual for a comedy show to have to fit that as a mission, right?
Yeah, and I think that a lot of us who watch the process often ask ourselves, why is it up to these guys to
do
this?
Right,
all
exactly.
All these other news organizations have these archives. They have the ability to do keyword searches based on transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
They can expose hypocrisy and track speeches that date back 10 years and put things next to each other and say, wow, this is crazy. Why aren't they doing it?
Right.
And my one main beef with Stewart, and less so Colbert, but mainly with Stewart, is at the heart of the criticism that his show has of mainstream political news. What's underlined here are issues of media economics. And granted, that's not hilarious, but he never goes there. He never exposes that part of the reason that this happened is because of a demand for ratings, of a destruction of the separation between news and entertainment. News is no longer protected in its status. It no longer is something that organizations do as a public service. It, too, is required to get ratings. Now, John never talks about that, and you can get kind of conspiratorial and say, well, that's because he's part of the Viacom empire, so why would he bite the hand that feeds him? But I do feel like it's a glaring omission
right.
from his otherwise in-depth analysis.
Yeah.
Is why do these inherent problems exist across news?
Right.
Never goes there.
Thanks, Curtis, for the call. Let's go to Aaron in Wausau next. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, for my news, I watch PBS so I can get the BBC news. Then I watch The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert. And for comedy, I watch Fox. That's all I got.
All right. Thanks, Aaron, very much for your call. Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just, a couple things. One is I do go, I watch CNN and other shows, but I also go to Daily Stewart. It kind of keeps me sane sometimes because he says he does the kind of research on people, the hypocrisy, both in journalism, in the media, and as well as politicians. But what's something that hasn't been mentioned is that I find him to be a great interviewer. I mean, he's had serious interviews with all sorts of people. I mean, Mike Huckabee and people from left and right, and they actually have a dialogue and they actually have an intelligent conversation. And I find that's often missing from other news organizations.
You can tell he does his homework. He reads, right? I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah, excellent comment. And in fact, this is something that I talk about, that many scholars have pointed out that what Jon Stewart does when he has a guest, particularly a guest with an opposing point of view on an issue, is something unlike what we see on most other programs when it comes to political debate or political conversation. And I read recently that CNN is bringing Crossfire back, and I wept.
Oh, really?
Wept quietly.
Who's doing the show? Who's doing the show?
Gosh, I think that Newt Gingrich is one of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, like back in its heyday. And part of what I think is destructive about those formats is that there is no attempt to model civic discourse. There's no attempt to model what it means to compromise, negotiate, or listen. And that's something that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert do. Stewart more so than Colbert, I'd say, because when Stewart is on his show, I have heard him actually say to Republican operatives and politicians, when I see this issue, he'll say, when I look at this issue, I see this.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I wrong?
Yeah.
Explain to me how I'm seeing this is wrong, because I don't see the way you see it.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes he'll be a little bit glib, and sometimes he'll use his humor to cut him off at the knees. But a lot of times what we're witnessing is a model that we don't see anywhere else about how people who think very different things can actually have a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And use some new people. Newt Gingrich, you know, we've heard all these people over and over for years and years. There's so many voices in America. It's one of the things I love about the people who produce this program is that they find new voices, and they're all over the place, for heaven's sake. Let's not hear the same people all the time yelling at each other. Who needs that? We're out of time. Thank you very, very much for being with us. It was really an interesting hour. Thanks, Dina.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was a great time.
Dana Young, her piece is Lighten Up, How Satire Will Make American Politics Relevant Again. And it is in the current issue of Columbia Journalism Review. That was interesting. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this hour. I'm going to be gone for a couple weeks, so I wanted to give you, if you don't mind, a couple announcements, because I won't be here to tell you about them. First of all, Eugene Schulz, who some of you will remember, our show used to be on in the morning in case you're just hearing us for the first time ever, which I guess is always possible. It's hard to believe, but it could be true. So we switched times a couple of weeks ago. We had Eugene on for several of our programs. He's the author of The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army. He's going to be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on August 6th at 7 p.m. Daniel Golden graciously offered a book signing for him. Eugene recently celebrated his 90th birthday. He has an extraordinary World War II experience to tell, including discovering the concentration camp, the first concentration camp, and telling the world about it. He is so worth listening to. Put it on your calendar. And when I return from being away, August 5th, it will be the one-year anniversary of the shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Pardeep Kalika, whose father was killed on that day, will be with us, along with a former white supremacist who now works with Pardeep and serve to unite, and they are doing incredibly valuable work. They're having a run walk on August 3rd from Oak Creek High School to the Sikh Temple, and there's more information about that. All of these things I've just said on the Kathleen Dunn Show to get details on that. So that's it. Great conversations ahead. Please stay tuned, and thanks so much for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.